I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne, host of Bullseye, inviting you to a live taping of my show with my pal, actor, and comedian Paul Scheer. It's June 13th at the Crawford. Get your tickets now at laist.com/events.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. Hope your day's off to a good start. Just to remind you, there's so many different ways to listen to the program, as well as all of what KPCC offers throughout the day and night. Your smartphone, streaming always, kpcc.org, podcasts of our programs, and of course, on your FM dial through our multiple transmitters from Santa Barbara to the Coachella Valley. Coming up later on, we'll talk about the anxiety that many folks say they're experiencing with businesses reopening, more people going to parks and to beaches and the like. All of this can be challenging psychologically as people get out into the world again. A recent poll that came out showed that even nearly half of those fully vaccinated have concerns about getting out into crowds again. We'll talk about that later this hour, and I want to hear you describe it a little bit, how you're managing that, where you think that anxiety comes from. We are, of course, very adaptable and very malleable humans, and so maybe it's just part of readapting to an open and more public world. But I'd like to hear from you about that later this hour on Air Talk. Also, next hour, we'll take an in-depth look at the new Georgia voting law, which has led Major League Baseball to move its All-Star game from Atlanta, also led a number of other Atlanta-based corporations to publicly criticize the new law in Georgia. But first, the very latest on COVID-19, joining us from Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Very good morning to you, Dr. Schreiner.
Likewise to you, Larry.
Let's start first with where we stand here in the state and gradual reopening of businesses, houses of worship, other public spaces. You feeling largely good about this, and what are your lingering concerns?
I am very concerned, actually. I think that, yes, we're in very good shape right now, and I'm very pleased that there's enthusiasm about the vaccines. The faster we get more people vaccinated, the better off we'll be. I think we're very, very worried about what's happening on the East Coast and in Europe, and it's possible that we could dodge that event because we have so much intrinsic disease in Southern California in particular. So many people have had COVID, and then so many people are getting vaccinated. But it's going to be a race to the finish here. I'm optimistic that we can get there, but I am very, very worried that what's happening back east is coming our way.
And given the high percentage of older people who've been vaccinated and those with underlying conditions, it seems, just from what I'm reading, that many of the cases in other parts of the country are of younger, unvaccinated people. We're still seeing the vaccines successful against the variants that are out there. Should we be heavily concerned by younger, healthy people getting COVID-19 if they're not going to end up being hospitalized?
Well, I think what's happening back east, Larry, is, again, very frightening. B.1.1.7, which appears to be the dominant variant among a few others that are circulating back there, not only is it more infectious, but it is deadlier. And so the hospitals back there are admitting lots of people who are much younger, certainly between 40 to 60 and even some younger than that. So I think the sort of adage that younger people don't get as sick and don't require hospitalization with these particular variants is becoming less likely. I think that people, there's a substantial risk that even though you're young, if you get these variants, that there's a risk that you could have very serious illness and perhaps be hospitalized.
So you have to be happy about the fact that we're about a week away from those 16 years of age and older being vaccine eligible. Riverside County today is extending eligibility to all county residents 16 and older. So that's going to help certainly with getting younger people without underlying conditions vaccinated.
Absolutely. And this is just, it's all about a race to the finish here. I mean, we are close, I think, to getting on top of this pandemic in this country. But these variants are very worrisome. And I think that the faster we get more people vaccinated, we know the vaccines hold up really well, even right now against the certain variants that are circulating. That could change if a more virulent variant emerges. And remember that the presence of the vaccine, when there's populations that are unvaccinated, that allows the virus to replicate, and when it replicates, it creates mutations. And so we have to be very worried that there could be a mutation that comes along that totally evades the vaccines. But right now, the vaccines seem very, very strong and very good. So the faster we get people vaccinated, the faster we can get on top of this.
If that bad scenario were to unfold and one of the variants showed that it was largely free to roam with the vaccines being ineffective against them, how quickly do you think the manufacturers might be able to come up with a very strain-specific booster that would be able to contain that variant?
That's the beauty of the mRNA vaccines, is that they can be scaled up very quickly. They can dial in different recipes. And my understanding is that both Pfizer and Moderna are doing that right now. They're looking at the variants that are circulating. They are trying to sort of guess which might be the nastier one. B.1.1.7 certainly is the dominant one that's raging through Europe right now, and it probably will be a problem here. But we have our own homegrown variants here in California, 1427, 1429. So I think that that's the beauty of the mRNA vaccines. And there's even some thought, which might even be the best way to go, is to create what we call a polyvalent vaccine, where you have sort of a potpourri of different types of antibodies in there or information to create antibodies to cover many different variants. That's what we do with influenza, and that may ultimately be what we have to do with coronavirus if these variants get on top of things.
If that was the case, then would people who had previously been vaccinated against a number of the longer-standing variants just take a booster then with the additional variants, or would you anticipate they would take this multivariant vaccine, which covers everything, including things for which they'd already been vaccinated?
It's hard to know. I think that our understanding of this virus still is emerging. You know, I want to point out the study came out a couple days ago about Pfizer's vaccine being effective up to 6 months. And I think there was some misinterpretation about that. A lot of people thought, well, the vaccine is only effective for 6 months, but that's not true. It's effective. We certainly know it's effective for at least 6 months because that's the data that we have. And even though these variants do seem to evade the current vaccines a little bit, remember Pfizer vaccine was created when we didn't have or didn't know about the variants, they still have enough common traits that they can cover the current variants that are emerging. A polyvalent vaccine would probably add a little more oomph to that and perhaps look at different parts of the virus to make the vaccine against. That's another option rather than just the spike protein, perhaps something that's common to all of these variants that would help us create a vaccine that's really effective for everything. But that science is ongoing right now, but the mRNA platform really gives us some flexibility with that.
Let's take this question from Michael in Orange County. How come Riverside is able to jump the line, so to speak, on the state guidelines for release of vaccines to those 16 and over? I thought that wasn't to occur until April 15th. Yeah, Michael, Long Beach, for example, went sooner than everyone else on 50 plus, as I recall, doing that a week earlier. They also started vaccinating teachers and grocery store employees earlier than other places. And I assume that has to do with the availability of appointments. Dr. Schreiner, you want to elaborate?
It's the availability of appointments. It's the decisions by the local health departments on what they want to do, where they want, what populations they want to target. And it's certainly the availability of vaccine as well. And so all of those three things play a role. The public health departments in each county have quite a bit of individual power. We have one, of course, in Pasadena. And so they can help sort of direct the vaccine distribution and targets towards vulnerable populations. But I think that hopefully all counties in the United States will begin to open things up very quickly in the next week. And boy, we sure need to do it.
And, you know, another factor, I'm not saying this is the case in Riverside County, it may not, but if you had a county where you had significant numbers of people who were vaccine resistant, then, you know, the flip side of that would be if you've got a supply based, you know, per capita on population, it would enable you to go to younger ages for vaccination if you had a higher percentage of older people who weren't currently seeking vaccination.
That's right. It's just all about supply and demand. We want the demand to be high because the vaccines are very safe. They are our only way out of this pandemic, and they will protect you and your family from getting sick and or dying from this disease.
We're at 866-893-KPECC. I look forward to your questions on COVID-19, on vaccinations, which is sort of where we've evolved in our daily update on the pandemic, is to get into the ins and outs of vaccination and the vaccines themselves. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Tweet at AirTalk, post on our Facebook page. Dr. Schreiner, we haven't heard much lately, I think at least in general media, about vaccines that might be ready to apply for FDA approval. Are there some that would be ready to go soon, like AstraZeneca, for example, or any of the others?
You know, the FDA approval process is a long and laborious bureaucratic process, and so I think that it's going to still be a little bit, but I think they're close. We certainly have accrued now quite a bit of data, not just the people that were in the original trial for the Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, but also the data around the country and certainly around the world for AstraZeneca and Pfizer, both of which are being used in other places. So I think that once the FDA feels that there's enough data to really give it official approval, they will. And I think we're getting close to that. I just don't know the ins and outs of how long it takes to get through that process. It's usually a pretty long process, often a couple of years. Obviously, in this situation, they're going to speed it up.
866-893-KPCC. Marty in Hollywood says, I've had my first Moderna injection, but I've been trying to get an appointment for my second shot of Moderna. The date I got was a day sooner than what was on my vaccine card. Is it okay to get the vaccine a day earlier than is the date on my card for second vaccine?
Yeah, for Marty, it's absolutely perfectly fine. Just go ahead and use the date that you've got. I think we're learning there's a fair bit of flexibility, not only, interestingly enough, in the timing around the second vaccine, but perhaps there may be some reasons even for doing it of mixing the vaccines up a little bit. That's being looked at in England right now. They've been very bold about coming up with different and creative ways of vaccinating. So there's some data looking at, you know, you do a Pfizer, then you get a Moderna, or you do a Pfizer, then you get a Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So I think that we're feeling a little bit more, a little safer in terms of kind of trying some different combinations to see which one is likely to create more immunity. But isn't it wonderful that a year after this pandemic, we're talking about vaccines already, vaccines that we have and are using? I mean, that's an incredible achievement, Larry, and I just wanted to reiterate our incredible scientists and pharmaceutical companies that have brought them to us.
Diana in Santa Monica asks for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Is there a plan for booster shots for variants with it?
It might be, yeah. I think all of the vaccine platforms have the capability of putting in different information should a more resistant pathogen emerge. Right now, Johnson & Johnson does a good job covering most of the variants. The South Africa variant's a little bit stickier, but not bad. The P1 variant that's coming out of Brazil is a very nasty variant that seems to create quite a bit of resistance. But all of the vaccines right now appear to cover the variants pretty well, with the exception of AstraZeneca with the 1351 in South Africa. That one was pulled from there because it doesn't seem to cover it. But so that's the good news. And as we move forward, just keeping an eye on variants and then dialing in different cocktails if we need to.
Sean in Westminster says, I participated in a double-blind clinical trial of a vaccine and was advised at the end to get one of the commercial vaccines. I still don't know whether I received actual vaccine in the study, but there's possibility that I could be double vaccinated. What does that mean for my antibody levels and for variants?
Well, it certainly will mean that you'll probably, if you did get the real vaccine, you might have a little more significant reaction with the second round of vaccines. Whether it really enhances your immunity by double vaccinating, we don't know. At a certain point, there's kind of diminishing returns. Your body knows, I know what to do with this. I don't need more of this. But it kind of depends a little bit, too, on if it was an AstraZeneca vaccine, then if you get a Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, that might cover things that maybe some of the AstraZeneca vaccine missed. But the most likely thing to happen is that if you did get the real vaccine, you might have a little more side effects with the second go-around, but nothing that should be too problematic.
We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist at Huntington Hospital, who's been a part of our KPCC family on air here for more than a year. And we're so pleased to have her with us in weekly visits, just like today, taking your questions at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. We haven't received this question in months, I think. Alan in Valley Village says he has an appointment to get his teeth cleaned. My hygienist and I have had all of our shots. Is it safe to do that kind of close contact? I sure hope so, Alan, because I've had my teeth cleaned twice in the last year, and neither of us were vaccinated. Dr. Schreiner.
Well, the dentists very early on, who were very high risk, actually, for acquiring COVID, and many of them did, have really instituted very good PPE from the beginning. So as you can see, Larry, you were very safe when you got your teeth cleaned. So, yes, now it's the time to kind of begin to pick up the pieces where you left off with all of your routine health care, including teeth cleaning and, of course, some more important things, cancer screening for women and men with breast cancer issues and colon cancer and so forth. So we have to kind of do mop up after we're out of the surge. I hope that we stay out of surges so that people can continue to kind of get back on track with their routine health care. But yes, it's safe to go to the dentist.
All right. Yeah, the precautions that I'm hearing dentists taking, including mine, quite extraordinary, actually, because they're the ones who are at the highest risk, as Dr. Schreiner is saying, seeing patients all day. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We have more questions for Dr. Schreiner coming up. And later this hour, I want to hear from you. We're going to open up the phones to talk about anxiety about being out in public again after so many months of being locked down. And I'm not just talking about concerns about getting sick or being exposed to the virus, but a little bit deeper than that, an anxiety over adjusting to being at home, not being out in larger groups, not getting together in a wide range of social settings. If you're feeling anxiety about that or hesitancy, let's talk about that. That's coming up later this hour on Air Talk. We'll be back with Dr. Schreiner in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena with us. Next hour, we're going to take a look at the malleability of memory. I don't know if you're like me, but you know, there are things I feel absolutely certain happened a certain way from my childhood. And then I'll hear other people talk about the same event, and it sounds entirely different than I remember it. And I wonder, is it my memory that's faulty? Did they store that memory differently? We're going to talk about the malleability of memory. That's coming up next hour. There's some interesting research into it. That's here on 89.3 KPCC and on the smartphone app. Let's see. We have Todd in Fullerton who asked Dr. Schreiner, I heard early in the pandemic there was some data suggesting it could affect fertility of women. I actually hadn't heard that, Todd. Is there any data on that? My wife doesn't want our 5-year-old daughter to get vaccinated if it would cause later in life fertility issues. Dr. Schreiner.
To my knowledge, there are no data that support that, Larry. And, you know, there could be potential things way down the road. But really, most vaccines don't do that. We've been using vaccines for decades, and fertility issues are really not related to them. So I think that that risk is pretty minimal, if zero. But there are no data right now on any of that information. So.
All right. Very good. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Catherine Santa Monica says, I have a friend who was fully vaccinated and became ill, not seriously, but she was suspicious it might be COVID-19 and tested positive even after being fully vaccinated. Is that another reason to be extra cautious even after full vaccination?
Absolutely. And that's why we're so adamant about encouraging people to continue to practice social distancing and wearing a mask and avoiding large groups of people. Remember that during the trials in Pfizer, 9 people became ill with COVID that were vaccinated. And in Moderna, I think it was 5. So we know that you can still contract the disease. It's much milder, of course. Remember that the vaccines are designed principally to protect you from dying from COVID and or having to be hospitalized. But they do appear to be very effective in actually preventing you from getting the disease as well. But there are going to be people who still get COVID. And so when you're vaccinated, that's not a reason to take your mask off and be extra risky with getting the disease, especially with these variants. And so it's really important that until we're completely done with this pandemic, you've got to be very, very cautious.
You know, the thing that I'm so looking forward to when I'm fully vaccinated is that feeling of freedom from the most severe form of COVID-19 and hospitalization. Not that I would welcome getting even a mild form of it, because my friends who've gotten it, who hadn't had to be hospitalized, still had a very tough bout with it. So I don't mean to minimize that. But given how serious the complications, and you've seen this on a daily basis, Dr. Schreiner, I mean, I think it is very freeing. I'm not saying toss the mask away, but just the idea of it lifts weight off one's shoulders.
That's absolutely true, Larry. And I think you could see it the day that all of our healthcare workers started getting vaccinated. They knew that they still had to be very cautious. They continue to be very cautious. But they've seen, they certainly see the worst, and they know very much about the variants. But I do think that just that protection that a vaccine provides is an enormous help in terms of kind of your ability to deal with things. But it isn't a free pass, and this virus is very tricky. We still don't know very much about it, and so we just have to be very cautious until clearly it's going away.
Julia in Redondo Beach says, I have 2 toddlers. They obviously are not going to be vaccinated for quite a while. How are parents of kids supposed to get back into the world if their kids aren't vaccinated?
Currently, both Pfizer and Moderna are looking at vaccines in young children. Moderna is dropping it down to 6 months of age. And so that information will probably be available in the next few months. The trials are smaller because they can use what's called bridging data. They can kind of see what happened in the adult trial for a lot of the children. So I think we're going to have information about very young children. Young children in general, very young children under 5, tend not to get very sick with the disease, although we do worry about this multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children. So I would still be cautious. I've been amazed at little kids that they're pretty darn good at wearing masks. I have 2 6-year-olds that live next door to me, and they are out there with their masks every day. So it's impressive. But I think that we need to be cautious. But I think that probably we'll get to the point where even very young children will be vaccinated.
I've been impressed, too. When I was a little kid, my grandfather being a doctor, there were times if someone was sick in the house, I'd be required to wear a mask even indoors as a little kid when I was visiting my grandparents. And, oh, man, that was so, as a kid, difficult. But I'm like you. I'm very impressed with what I see with kids out in the world. 866-893-KPECC. Amy tweets at AirTalk, I haven't been wearing my wedding rings because I thought I read hand sanitizer can't get into all the nooks and crannies where germs can hide. However, I received my first Moderna shot 3 weeks ago. Can I start wearing my rings again? That's Amy.
Well, yes, keep washing your hands, Amy. The hand sanitizer gets into pretty good nooks and crannies, and so I would wear your wedding rings if that's meaningful to you and your spouse.
Mary writes on our Facebook page, my kids have been isolated for so long, I'd like to start doing social things again. Is it okay if we're fully vaccinated and our friends are, but none of our kids are vaccinated?
Again, young children, depends on how old they are, but children tend not to get as sick, but they are pretty effective spreaders of the disease. So until the children are vaccinated, I think you still need to be cautious. I would keep the groups relatively small. And again, encourage mask wearing when they're together, maybe have more activities outside. But in general, that's a safe activity if the adults are vaccinated. But I just, at this point, we're going to probably end up encouraging all people, you know, over, you know, even toddlers getting vaccinated down the road. So I think we still need to be cautious.
Norma is actually sitting, waiting for her 15 minutes after being vaccinated. Norma, thanks for checking in, listening on her smartphone, and I assume lots of people. Now I'm reading about kids and variants, and it's making me anxious, she says. Well, you're straddling two segments there, Norma, vaccination and the anxiety we'll talk about later this hour. Thanks, and hope all is well with your vaccination process. Esther in Westwood wonders about some people who've gotten Bell's palsy as a side effect of vaccination. Is it safe for someone who's had Bell's palsy in the past to be vaccinated?
Yes, it is. Bell's palsy is very, very common. It wasn't clear whether the Bell's palsy that occurred in the Moderna and Pfizer trials was directly related to the vaccine, because it's such a common phenomenon. But having had Bell's palsy is not a reason not to get the vaccine. Go ahead and get vaccinated. It's safe. It's unlikely to create another Bell's palsy. And even in those individuals who did get Bell's palsy during the trials, my understanding is it resolved. So it's a very common thing that happens regardless of vaccination status. But we know that COVID is a very dangerous virus, so get vaccinated.
Jill in La Crescenta says, if you've been fully vaccinated, you get a comparatively mild case of COVID-19 after full vaccination. Is it possible to become someone with long-haul symptoms?
That's an excellent question, Jill, and we don't know yet. We're just beginning to crack the surface a little bit on this syndrome, which seems to be quite common. Up to 30% of people who've had COVID may develop this syndrome. We don't know the effects of vaccine. There have been anecdotal information coming through now that individuals who do have long-haul syndrome actually feel better after they've been vaccinated. It's as if the vaccines kind of reset things. People that have had vaccinations and then get COVID, whether they're susceptible to long-haul syndrome or not, we don't know, but that's an important thing to study. So a very interesting but disturbing consequence of COVID infection.
Yeah, and it's got to be hard with those anecdotal reports. I mean, as good as it is to hear that, there's still the possibility for placebo effect, right? Unless we actually are able to study that in a more objective way.
That's true, Larry, and we're actually at Huntington establishing a clinic to look at that, and many hospitals around town and areas. Cedars has a long-haul clinic. I'm sure UCLA is developing one. So it's a very interesting but concerning phenomenon, because it's quite common. And if you think of the number of people around the world that have had COVID, up to 98 million people probably have had COVID at this point. There's a lot of undiagnosed disease. If 30% of those people have long-term sequelae from the infection that prevents them from working or, you know, really causing a lot of disease, that's an enormous health problem.
We have two listeners, Sarah and Amy, asking essentially the same question about the ability to transfer antibodies from mother to nursing child. They want to know, you know, can you measure that? If this happens, about how long would the antibodies last when nursing ends? What do we know about that potential?
Well, there are some data that do show that nursing mothers do transfer protective antibodies to their nursing infant. How long those antibodies last and how protective they are is unclear. So that's the data that's being looked at in the pediatric population. Again, the incidence of illness in very young children, infants, is quite low, and so that would require a very large study to be done to see if nursing infants were more protected than infants that weren't getting breast milk. But we do know that the breast milk does contain protective antibodies, and so presumably there is some kind of protection there.
All right, 866-893-KPECC, Air Talk page, kpecc.org, our Facebook page, or you can tweet at Air Talk. California had a promised very robust contact tracing system. The governor announced thousands of California state workers would be redirected into contact tracing. And then, of course, we got overwhelmed with cases, making it extremely difficult to carry that out. Are the cases now low enough that it is possible to do extensive contact tracing?
It's just all about personnel and training. And so a pandemic on this level, it's pretty hard to do effective contact tracing. And I think at this point, a lot of those personnel that were designated contact tracers are now in vaccination clinics just trying to crank through vaccines for people. And that probably is a higher priority than doing contact tracing. It's still a very important part of keeping a pandemic under control and monitoring. And I think as this begins to subside, you know, this isn't just going to go away. It's going to continue for many years, probably on hopefully very low levels. But that's where contact tracing will become very important. And contact tracing is important to make sure that you're looking for new pathogens that might come along. There's no reason to think that we couldn't have another pandemic of some sort right on top of this one, which is a scary thought, but it's possible. So I think that the robustness of our public health departments needs to be ensured as we move forward and try not to have to repeat what happened this time.
Has this experience with this pandemic changed public health officials' views about contact tracing and how to conduct contact tracing?
I think that I don't want to speak for them because that's a really specialty that's very much in their purview. But I know that even in Pasadena with Dr. Goh, you know, that they have been able to figure out the priorities, how to do different types of tracing. You know, social media has allowed us to utilize that kind of route rather than having to sort of knock on doors. A lot of contact tracing depends on sort of honesty and transparency of people that you're following. So I think that there's more tools now for epidemiologists and public health officials. And I think that they've been able to hone those skills as we've moved through this pandemic. But it's been such an overwhelming event that I think that just in terms of the most important part is having the personnel to do it. And that's been very, very challenging.
Also, with so many fewer people being tested now for COVID-19, does that make it particularly difficult to get robust contact tracing?
Absolutely. I think that the testing has fallen off a little bit. Now, in large part, that's due because, you know, so many people have either had it or are vaccinated now and so are not experiencing symptoms. So that's a good thing. But we do need to keep testing platforms open and continue to do that. As things sort of settle down a little bit, the health departments can go out and do random testing, sort of spot checking to see if the community is starting to see development of disease. And that's being done actually right now throughout most counties and public health departments. So we need to be careful about, you know, monitoring testing. And we need to continue to develop very novel ways of testing, easy testing that perhaps can be, that are highly accurate and can be done at home or can be done very easily without having to do the deep nasopharyngeal swabs.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schreiner. I appreciate your being with us and always offering us your expertise each week. We wish you well. And again, our thanks to not just you, but all your colleagues at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's a pleasure to do your show.
Thank you. That's Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Now I want to ask you, if you're feeling anxious about going out into the world again, and not just because of health reasons, that might be part of it, but might as well have to do with just the psychology of it, then I want to hear from you at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. A recent survey shows nearly half of those say even after full vaccination, they're hesitant about going out in public and interacting with other people. If that's you, I'd like to hear about your experience. What are your plans? Are you easing yourself into that? Are you holding off going out in the world even if you're fully vaccinated? What sorts of emotional obstacles are you facing in that process? It's vital that I hear from you. If you're going through that, please call us right now at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 90 seconds.
On Inheriting, Victoria Uch grew up in a large Cambodian community in Long Beach, California. When she visits her local Buddhist temple, she's reminded of a brutal past.
Everyone here is a survivor of the genocide.
Memories of life under the Khmer Rouge still haunt her dad.
When you suffer this kind of thing, hunger is not the worst.
But how does his past affect Victoria's present? Listen to Inheriting from LAS Studios and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.